You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As usual, I'm your host, Ankit Pandit, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Prashant Parameswaran. Thanks for joining me, Prashant.
Great to be here.
So there's a lot going on in Asia these days, and we haven't done this podcast in a couple weeks. I was a little bit under the weather, but I'm back in business now. So we'll come back into this in a full swing. So China's growth numbers came out yesterday for Q3, showing a 6.9% growth rate in the official, if the official statistics are to be believed. South Korean President Park Geun-hye just left the United States after a state visit. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe became the first Japanese prime minister to step on board a U.S. aircraft carrier. The USS Reagan just arrived in Japan. And recently, just a couple weeks ago, the foreign and defense ministers of Australia held a 2+2 dialogue with their counterparts in the United States. And on this podcast, I think, instead of focusing specifically on some of these issues, which are very interesting, and we've been covering them over at the website, and I think Prashant and I have both written quite a bit about these things, so you can go check our thoughts on these issues over there. I think on the podcast, we'll do something different and discuss the role of the next U.S. president in setting the country's Asia policy and managing the pivot or rebalance to Asia that was launched in 2011 by the Obama administration. As listeners, both in the United States and elsewhere will be aware, the U.S. presidential primary campaigns are in full swing with both the Democrats and the Republicans vying for their party's nomination. Of course, when it comes to foreign policy, most of the attention during the three presidential debates so far, two Republican debates, one Democratic debate, and various articles and comments by candidates on op-ed pages and interviews. When it comes to foreign policy, most of the attention has been on the Middle East, and this shouldn't be surprising. The Middle East always receives a disproportionate amount of attention in the U.S. foreign policy discourse, but Asia is incredibly important. It's home to 4.5 billion people, a third of global economic output, and it'll be immensely significant. The next U.S. president will be charged with managing U.S. foreign policy in Asia. So I think it's an interesting topic to discuss. And, when it comes to these presidential candidates, there's a range of experience and a range of positions on Asia. And specifically, I think the big issues when it comes to Asia so far we've seen are the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal that on the Democratic side has been receiving a lot of criticism. On the Republican side, things are a little bit different. U.S.-China relations was obviously a big topic. Xi Jinping's state visit occurred right as the second GOP debate was about to take place. So we saw some candidates coming out in very strong terms, calling for the state visit to be canceled or to be downgraded. And some of the candidates who are a little bit more bookish when it comes to foreign policy have even mentioned things like the South China Sea and the East China Sea disputes. Anyways, enough for me. Prashant, I want to turn it over to you. When it comes to the discourse on Asia so far in the presidential field, have you been surprised at the level of attention that Asia has been receiving, or is this, pretty much what you expected?
Yeah, I think it's been pretty much what you would expect. So a couple of general things on Asia and presidential elections. So it tends to be the case that because there's a general bipartisan consensus on Asia relative to some of the other regions, usually policy on Asia is not very controversial relative to some of the other areas of priority. And there's also significant differences between what the candidates say versus what they actually end up doing, particularly on, and I think we'll go into the specific issues later, but how they deal with China. There's a tendency to sound a lot tougher on China than the actual conduct of foreign policy once they actually get into office. So I think those things have definitely played out, and I think we should keep those things generally in mind. We mentioned earlier some of the themes that have been discussed. So we've seen, the things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a little bit of a focus on the South China Sea, somewhat on China. And in general, I think the theme where Asia sort of fit in is this idea of how tough should we be on foreign policy, right? And I think there's a criticism that President Obama and his administration, were not tough enough, whether it comes to the Middle East or East Asia. And so some candidates are trying to use China and Asia and some of the other issues to say, well, we should be tougher in this way or in that way. So that's sort of been the major theme so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question of a U.S. global leadership, really. A lot of these candidates see the United States as indispensable. They think that the United States needs to continue writing the rules of international order. It needs to underwrite the liberal international order that was set up after the Second World War. I want to go back to the point that you made, which I really appreciate, which is that presidential campaign rhetoric is very different from how presidents actually behave. And I wanted to ask you, do you think that's an artifact of the foreign policy bureaucratic process in the United States itself? The president is ultimately surrounded by a coterie of advisors, bureaucrats, experts, academics who, will usually give best practices and advice on how to approach many of these global issues. Or do you think it's more an issue of populism? Do you think that U.S. voters like hearing things like, we will prevent China from taking over the South China Sea, from writing the rules for the future of trade in Asia? What's your take on that?
Yeah, so I think in general there's a couple of reasons. So I think as you pointed out, it's absolutely right that what you say on the campaign trail versus how you act has to do with the apparatus and the advisors around you, and those things tend to be made closer to when the election actually occurs. So right now, I mean, the specific policy advisors on Asia have not really been picked for the candidates in terms of having Asia teams and specific regional teams. They do have advisors, but the specifics on regions and issues will come much later when we get closer to the actual election. And once they take office, there will be, the whole series of assistant secretaries of state and so on and so forth, and they'll have their own takes as to what's going on. But I think also the other issue is that Asia in general tends to be a place of opportunity rather than a place of threat. So relative to the Middle East, where sort of it tends to be viewed as a quagmire, sort of, in the last election you saw the big debate was on Afghanistan and Iraq and whether getting too involved in wars was going to be a major issue. Now we've sort of seen the pendulum swing the other way, where the debate has sort of shifted to say, has President Obama and the Obama administration, have they overcompensated by making America's leadership in the world, quote unquote, weak, in the sense of not responding to Russian adventurism, not responding to Chinese advances in the South China Sea, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the context in which this whole thing is factoring in. So you can expect toughness to be in the debate because candidates are criticizing the incumbent. And President Obama, relative to the previous administrations, right, has been relatively less involved and less willing to be involved in foreign adventures. So the toughness in the actual debates may not actually match what happens in reality because as tough as you are in terms of your rhetoric, the candidates haven't really been very specific about what they would do differently. So, for example, if Carly Fiorina is saying something about the South China Sea and our need to be tougher, the question really would be what would be the tougher measures that she would take in the South China Sea? And I'm not sure if she would have a very particular answer as to what that would be, or whether there's some other candidates who are talking about how we need to be tougher on China. And I don't know if when they take office, they'll actually implement actions that would actually be like that. And a lot of this, actually, the last point I'd make is a lot of these actions, what candidates say on the campaign trail, is actually going to, what they actually do in office is going to be determined not only by what they want to do, but also what happens in the international system and what happens regionally in Asia.
Oh,
So
absolutely. Yeah.
that's the other point that I would bring up.
Yeah, I mean, the United States, doesn't get to pick its own conflicts. It doesn't get to pick where it has to get involved in the world anymore. It's an unfortunate consequence of, the rise of the rest, as, Fareed Zakaria has put it, I guess. I do want to go back to, how the America needs to be strong rhetoric manifests on both sides of the aisle. Let's maybe take this party by party. So let's start with the GOP, which, is the party of Ronald Reagan, going back to the Cold War. We've seen a lot of candidates actually evoke Reagan's sort of mantra of peace through strength, when it comes to managing U.S. relations with China. I know that Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, maybe even Jeb Bush and John Kasich have sort of used similar rhetoric. But you're absolutely right. When it comes to specifics on the South China Sea, I know I've heard Rubio and Kasich at least talk about, freedom of navigation patrols sending the U.S. Navy into the South China Sea, which is essentially what the Obama administration, as we know, is. They've come around to that. We are expecting to see freedom of navigation patrols start any day in the South China Sea.
Right.
So we haven't really seen any sort of innovation or ingenuity when it comes to managing these very difficult topics of international affairs in Asia. Who's when it comes to the Republican field, Prashant, what's your sense of the discourse on China? I mean, obviously there is a lot of trying to one up each other on I mean, okay, so first of all, I should note that the Republican candidates, I believe there's 16 of them now. It used to be 17. Scott Walker dropped out, so I think there's 16 campaigns still running, and they're all trying to outdo each other on a range of topics, GDP growth, immigration, and when it comes to China, it's been the same. Right before Xi Jinping's state visit, Scott Walker came out and said the state visit to be canceled. Rubio said, "Okay, maybe we shouldn't cancel it. We should maybe downgrade it." But there's been a lot of trying to one-up each other. What's struck you about the GOP field so far when it comes to China and Asia in general?
Yeah, I think you summarized the China part of the equation really well, which is that it's essentially a battle for toughness, right? So when you saw the debate about the state visit, for example, Xi Jinping's state visit, you saw Scott Walker and a few others saying, I think Carly Fiorina also mentioned this, that the state visit should either be canceled or downgraded. But you saw other people like Jeb Bush, for example, saying, that might be a little bit too tough, but we should still ramp up our actions against China, whether it be in the cyber domain and elsewhere. So that's sort of been the rhetoric on China. On TPP, as you mentioned earlier, that tends to be more of a debate on the Democrat side rather than the Republicans. On the South China Sea, as I mentioned earlier, you've seen Fiorina has made specific comments on the South China Sea, and she's been very quote unquote tough on China. But again, like many of the other candidates, and I think this is what we can sort of expect in the race, they're not going to put forth very specific proposals about what they would do differently specifically on these issues. And in fact, as you mentioned earlier, and I'd agree with that, the fact that the South China Sea is even being mentioned in these debates is a surprise to some, because that would indicate that there's even more level of understanding of Asia than is usually the case. I think one other thing I would mention is, there's been some emphasis on Donald Trump and his questions about Japan and South Korea and how reliant they are on the United States and whether this is a sustainable thing for Washington. And that's another example of how you have rhetoric that is on the campaign trail, but you have to ask yourself the question, which is, if Donald Trump, hypothetically, right, became president of the United States, would he really then withdraw U.S. troops from East Asia? And I think the answer is, clearly no. But the fact is that when candidates are making these statements on the campaign trail, and there's so little focus on Asia, whatever they do say on Asia does get a lot of emphasis. And I think internationally, people are more worried than they should be, because people have been saying that Donald Trump should be declining in the polls for a while now, and that hasn't really come to pass as much as people thought, and as quickly as they thought it would come.
I hope Shinzo Abe is getting some sleep at night, but I can't imagine that it's easy watching these debates for them. I do want to go back to the issue about the South China Sea. It's interesting. I mean, I think, three candidates, okay, at least from my perspective, I'm just speaking here in my personal capacity, three candidates stood out to me on Asia. I mean, have stood out to me so far. So Hillary Clinton, obviously, everybody expected her to have strong foreign policy chops since she was Secretary of State, traveled across the world, has close personal relationships with many world leaders in Asia and elsewhere. So obviously, it's no surprise that she's a strong contender when it comes to Asia policy. She was in the a part of the administration when the pivot was announced. She supported the TPP initially, and she stood against it. She announced that she's now against the deal. We can talk about that later. Apart from Hillary on the apart from Hillary on the Democrat side, there's also Jim Webb. Jim Webb was interesting at the debate. He actually, I think, identified himself as one of the architects of the pivot to Asia, which is an interesting way to put it. Since I guess, he was, Secretary of the Navy under Ronald Reagan. He was a Marine, fought in Vietnam, decorated war hero. He specifically mentioned the South China Sea, and actually last week he spoke at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and he, not only discussed South China Sea, he specifically mentioned the Spratlys, the Paracels, Okinawa, the East China Sea. I mean, he really is trying to paint himself as a well-educated, Asia wonk, and a guy who will really, handle the relationship with China. I think it's also interesting that during the debate, he kind of came out as probably the Democrat who would, probably be the strongest on China on these security issues. He really came out, said, China is making these sort of illegitimate sovereignty claims that the United States needs to be stronger. So that's very interesting. On the Republican side, I think, when it comes to specific knowledge of Asia, the only candidate that really stands out, I think, is Marco Rubio. I mean, he's really tried to pitch himself as a bookish sort of foreign policy intellectual. He's been authoring essays in foreign affairs. He spoke at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's really tried to kind of show himself as this thinking man's, hawk. I mean, he is a hawk. He is very much in favor of using U.S. power to hold up the liberal order, to, he's a very much a proponent of the idea of an indispensable America. So I think, those three have really stood out to me when it comes to Asia. And obviously, there's pros and cons to, I mean, their takes on things. And I don't think either any of these candidates have proposed anything particularly innovative when it comes to dealing with these very difficult challenges in Asia, like the South China Sea, like the East China Sea. But in my mind, those three have stood out. Has anyone, that I didn't mention maybe stood out to you, Prashant?
No, I think you're right. Those would be the three that would be strongest on Asia. And I think with Clinton, the pivot to Asia is the interesting angle, obviously. But she has a little bit of a tough time because on TPP in particular, because she is a Democrat, and she's running against Bernie Sanders, who sort of is to her left. She has to sort of, she's had to walk away from TPP in ways that I think she would prefer not to otherwise for policy reasons. So it's kind of a tricky balance for her, and to a certain degree, she's almost running away from part of her pivot, her Asia experience. With Webb, you see it's kind of a different dynamic. I think he's trying to highlight the fact that not only the administration's pivot to Asia was important, but he, in fact, was involved in the pivot even before it began, and that is a true statement because he was involved not only in some of these big issues like China and some of the security issues like South China Sea, but he also was involved heavily in Southeast Asia, particularly the administration's outreach to Myanmar. Jim Webb was one of the first people in Congress to take an active role in that. And that's one of, I would argue, one of the big successes of the Obama administration. But again, this is really not a great time to be talking about Myanmar either and U.S. policy. So you do have this very interesting dynamic where candidates are trying to claim credit for Asia, but when they get to the specifics, it's a troubling issue because either they don't have the specifics to back it up or the current trends don't really fit with what they had done in the past.
A TPP is going to stick around for the duration of this campaign. I mean, it looks like Congress won't seriously entertain ratification until the lame duck session in late 2016. Obama leaves office in 2017. We'll have a new president in January. But TPP will be an issue through November. And it'll be very interesting to see how the candidates field it. I mean, particularly once we get to the phase where we have the two nominees and we'll see actually more, nuanced debate on foreign policy. It'll be interesting to see how the TPP issue is navigated. And for listeners that may not be aware, the TPP negotiations actually concluded last week. And 2 weeks ago, I believe. And now the process is ratification. Okay, so Prashant, where do you think someone like Hillary is going to go on security issues? She didn't really talk about it too much at the debate, but obviously, as an architect of the pivot, I think I expect to hear more on that from her going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think traditionally Hillary Clinton's viewed as kind of a hawk on Asia policy. I think in particular the Chinese are, there's a perception, at least among some in China, that not only is she going to be a lot tougher on them when she gets into office, but in fact, some people going as far as saying that if China wants to do anything now, the time for doing it is now before the presidency switches because it could be a lot tougher. But I think on the issue really comes down to two things. One is specifics. I mean, what would she do differently that the Obama administration would do differently? So, and the second thing is, I would say, goes back to the early point that I made, which is that it really depends not only on what the president's outlook is, but also the challenges that they face. So you'll recall, for example, when the Obama administration came into office initially, there was a rhetoric about strategic reassurance with China, cooperation on climate change. Obama didn't meet with the Dalai Lama very controversially, and some people were saying that the Obama administration was very soft on China. But you fast forward 2 terms later, what's going on is that you've seen Chinese assertiveness in the South China Sea, and even the Obama administration, which some people might argue was initially started out very soft on China, has had to shift its own foreign policy with respect to China because of the circumstances that it found itself in. So even if you do have an administration, a Clinton administration, that goes in and tries to be tough on China, I mean, there might be certain events or certain developments in other parts of the world that could change that foreign policy outlook moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Do you think normative issues with China will continue to be an important part of the presidential process? I mean, at least on the GOP side, we've heard a lot about human rights. You know, guys like Ted Cruz, for example, sponsored this resolution before Xi's visit. I believe he'd brought it up a few years ago, but he brought it up again, which is to rename the plaza in front of the Chinese embassy in D.C. A Liu Xiaobo Plaza, which would have been incredibly controversial and probably upset China quite a bit. But do you think, you know, a grandstanding on the human rights and democracy and Tibet, all of these normative issues that you really don't hear about anymore when it comes to U.S.-China symmetry or high-level diplomacy. Do you think those will be part of the debate process?
So I think two things to say about that. First is that, you know, in general, even some of the quote-unquote tougher candidates on Asia and China that we're talking about, like Hillary Clinton is one example. You know, Clinton initially in the early years of the Obama administration had a statement, I think it was the first year the Obama administration was in office, saying that human rights should not be allowed to interfere in the commercial relationship between the U.S. and China. She subsequently clarified that and said that that wasn't what she meant. But, you know, the inclination that people had from that was that human rights was being downgraded as a priority relative to some of the other strategic considerations that the United States had. But I think the important thing to keep in mind, because, you know, democracy and human rights, you definitely see it moving across administrations in different ways and evolving. But what we have to keep in mind is what you mentioned earlier, which is that in addition to the candidates themselves and the presidency, there's a lot of other forces at work that help put U.S. human rights and democracy priorities into practice. So one important organ there would be Congress. Regardless of who the president is, Congress is always talking about democracy and human rights with respect to China. And there are any number of other organizations like the International Republican Institute, the National Endowment for Democracy, which, you know, not only talk about democracy and human rights promotion, but actually do it in terms of financing some of these initiatives. So regardless of what you see in terms of the candidates and the debates, and you'll see a lot of posturing with respect to, you know, what China is doing and how it is relative to the United States. But I think that will be the key, which is that how the president navigates these various forces. One last thing I'll say is there's also internal debates between the various parties. And I guess, you know, one of the old debates is what is the place of, you know, things like normative issues and values, human rights, democracy, in U.S. foreign policy has been a difference, particularly on the Republican side, between what some see as, you know, sort of the old school Republicans who sort of believe in a more realist foreign policy posture, and the so-called neoconservatives. Now, I don't think the neoconservatives exerted before a significant influence in foreign policy as people say that they did or do. But I do think that there are differences even within the parties regarding some of these issues. So I think we may see some of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I want to go back to, you know, you made that comment about Trump and how he wants to pull U.S. troops out from, you know, Japan and South Korea. And, you know, there is this issue of the offshore balancers, and it's very popular to be hawkish on the budget. In fact, on the Republican side, if you're not a neoconservative, you're probably hawkish about the budget. You think the United States has too much of a global presence, needs to cut down, needs to invest more in things at home. How do you think the offshore balancers, I guess I would include maybe, you know, Trump to an extent, Rand Paul is certainly, you know, of that ilk. Do you think that will become more of a force when it comes to discussions about Asia? I mean, obviously, the entire pivot to Asia is premised on the antithesis of offshore balancing. So how do you think we'll see that play out?
Yeah, so I mean, that's a really interesting question, because I think it goes back to the issue of what are the structural considerations under which U.S. foreign policy operates. So the idea of offshore balancing has traditionally been more popular when you have, one, a very weak U.S. economy, usually in the midst of a crisis, and two, when threats in terms of, you know, foreign threats from countries or issues are relatively low. I would say that both of those conditions don't really exist now. In fact, we have a U.S. economy that's on the uptick, and we have rising threats, or at least candidates talking about rising threats, you know, whether it's China or Russia, the Islamic State. So under these conditions, where you have an improved economy and rising threats, you have more of a tendency to advertise for a greater U.S. presence in some way or in some fashion, relative to a more reduced, sort of a reduced U.S. presence. Now, those things could change. There are a lot of considerations in terms of differences between the candidates as to how that manifests. But I think that relative to the last elections, when we had, for example, President Obama come in amidst a weakened U.S. economy and, you know, a stretched United States in Iraq and Afghanistan, I definitely think the environment is less favorable to that kind of offshore balancing than it would be the case.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I also wonder with China's I don't want to say economic downturn. I mean, certainly slowdown, certainly volatility. I wonder if we'll see, the narrative that China is, beating the United States at all things increasingly challenged. I mean, it's been very interesting. I mean, even in the mid 2000s when, or at least in 2007, 2008, when you polled Americans and you asked them who is the number one economic power in the world, a lot of them would tell you China. But, China wasn't even second back then. Japan was second. So, there's always been this perception that China is a lot more successful than it is economically, strategically. And certainly on the Republican side, we've seen that, a narrative been used by a lot of the candidates. I mean, Donald Trump's whole thing is China's beating us at everything. We have to make America great again. And I wonder if, we'll see any candidate come out and, take stock of the fact that, China is slowing down a bit. I imagine we'd see that more on the Democratic side, but I don't know. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think that that's definitely a reality in terms of the worrying concerns about China's economic slowdown. The problem is when you have a presidential debate like this, and as I mentioned, you know, it's a threat environment where you're talking about rising threats and you have an improved U.S. economy. The narrative of big China that's being very assertive and a threat to U.S. interests is a lot more of a attractive image rather than a China that's slowing down, because that if you say China is slowing down, then that's one less of a reason for the United States to be more actively involved internationally. And a lot of these candidates are trying to sound tougher on foreign policy. So it's an issue really of the reality not really matching with what these candidates want to say. So even though that's really an accurate assumption, I mean, I think a lot of people who are seriously thinking about Asia are worried about China's economic slowdown. The candidates may not find it A, convenient to do so, and B, it's also a tougher and more nuanced argument to make. You have to get down to the economic fundamentals, and I think it's much easier to deliver a 10 to 15 second soundbite about how much of a threat China is rather than have a nuanced discussion about China's economic future and what that means for the region and the United States.
Absolutely. My impression is that when it comes to both sides of the aisle so far, nuance and detail and accuracy haven't really been high on the list of priorities when it comes to talking about Asia or about a lot of foreign policy topics, actually. So I guess my recommendation would be that these candidates read The Diplomat a bit more. Can't go wrong. But anyways, Prashant, I think we'll end it there this week, and we'll be back next week with more. Thanks for listening.